Let me share with you today's Bible reading. It comes from Matthew chapter 9. This reading actually is in two other sections in the Bible. It's recorded three times. I'm reading this one just at this time. Matthew chapter 9. While he was saying this, a synagogue leader came to him and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." Jesus got up from what he was doing and went with him, and so did his disciples. Just then a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, "If only I could touch his cloak, I will be healed." Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter," he said. "Your faith has healed you." And the woman was indeed healed at that very moment. When Jesus entered the synagogue, the synagogue leader's house, and saw the noisy crowd and the people playing pipes, he said, "Go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him. But after the crowd had been put out, he went in and took the girl by the hand and said, "Get up." News of this spread throughout the whole region. A very disruptive and inconvenient day in Jesus' life, and we're going to delve into that very soon.
Can I just get you to put your thinking caps on for a minute? All right, you got your thinking caps on?
I want you to go back. Think of old cop shows, police shows. Who remembers The Professionals? Yeah, Mark remembers The Professionals? How cool... Bodie and Doyle, how cool was an escort? Yeah, yeah. A Ford escort. Yeah, sorry. I didn't even go there, but anyway, a Ford escort. Cop shows, yeah. And what about Starsky and Hutch? Yeah, okay. Now, what did they have? They had a big red car with a white stripe on it. That's what they had. Okay, what about some of the older folk, black and white? I vaguely remember this show, but the line was, "Just the facts, ma'am, just give me the facts." Dragnet, very good, I thought it was. All right, well, Matthew chapter 9 is a bit of a dragnet part of this story that we're here. It's just the facts. If you have a look at it, it's a very short version of the story. When I read it out, did you think there's got to be something missing out of that story? No, it's just me. Just the way I read it, there was things missing. Okay, well, just me. I just went, seriously, that's what happened? Jesus is sitting there. He's mildly teaching. Someone walks in, "My daughter's just died." And he gets up. "Boys, we just got to go." Very casual. There's no emotion. There's no extremities. There's no, no. Even the synagogue guy's just going, my daughter, 12 years old, she just died. If you come and lay your hands on her, she'll be fine. It's just very just the facts. And then it goes, and Jesus and his disciples left. And as they were walking along, a woman who'd been bleeding for 12 years, hemorrhaging I think is the correct word, reached out and touched him, thinking, "If I do that, I'll be healed." And it's just the facts. It's just matter of fact about what's going on. When in fact, it's a lot more than just that. So much so that the Bible does tell us in Mark chapter 5, reading from verse 21. Now, Matthew 9 is 18 to 26, so it's not a lot of verses. This one is 21 to 43, so it's 22 verses. So there's more than just the facts in this part of the story. And it's a part of Jesus' disrupted day. Let me read through this part for you. When Jesus had again crossed over by the boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd had gathered. So he's just not teaching a few people here. He's teaching a massive crowd. A massive crowd, a large crowd had gathered. And then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus, we find out what his name is, comes along and he saw Jesus. He fell at his feet. Now, if you fall at someone's feet, there's a lot more emotion going on there, isn't there? There's stuff that's happening here. There's more to the story. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." Now, in the Matthew 9 one, what did we learn about the daughter? She had died.
And this one, she is dying. So what is it? Is she dead or is she dying? If she's dead, that explains Matthew, Jesus going, okay, let's just walk because it doesn't matter how long I'm getting there because she's dead. But if she's dying, then in my heart, there'd be some urgency. You know what I mean? If I get a phone call from the hospital, Donnie, we've got a lady who's gone into a coma. She needs someone to be with her at the end of life stuff. Can you please come? Then I get dressed very quickly because she's at the end of life. She's dying. But if she's already passed away, then guess what? It might sound callous, but I don't rush. Okay? This one's dying, this one's dead. Well, the Greek words, and I'm not going to go into it because I looked very bad last time, but the Greek word in the book of Matthew is to bring to an end, to finish life, and to close. So, yeah, dying or dead. This one in the book of Mark is to end the point of death, and it's actually where we get the word eschatology from, so the end times, the coming to an end. So that's the two wordings that are used, so that can be translated in both ways without being seen as incorrect. Does that make sense? All right, very good. So let's keep going. So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed. Now from the Matthew one, it's just a little, we don't know how much of a crowd it is, but this one, a large crowd has followed. Obviously, if you're teaching away and then all of a sudden some guy comes and grabs your feet and cries out in earnestness about his daughter is dying, then people would be curious, don't you think? Well, what's going to happen here? Let's go and find what happens. What's Jesus going to do with this girl who's dying? And so they're on their way. And a woman there who was subjected to bleeding for 12 years. How old's the little girl? 12. 12. Oh, maybe it's just one of those days Jesus is having. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors. So Mark's going into this great detail, and you could just imagine what this poor woman would have gone through under the doctors back in those days. Any engineers in the house? Yes. You don't build roads, do you, sir? Oh, good, because I would have to repent. I am really hell-bent on engineers building our roads at the moment. They're making lots of mistakes. And I'm getting stuck in traffic jams. The big one called the Bruce Car Park. My goodness. I reckon the doctors in these days were like our engineers building roads today. They didn't do a real good job. And she went through huge suffering and pain. And she spent all her money and time. And instead of getting better, she grew worse. That's not good, hey? When she heard about Jesus, she came up from behind him in the crowd and reached out and touched his cloak because she thought, if I could just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Wow! Isn't that a massive statement of faith? If I could just touch his cloak, I will be healed. This torment that I've been going through for 12 years would be gone. She reaches out, and immediately after the bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Wow! Do you think she was smiling? Do you think something was happening in her in this big crowd? Something's going on. And she's just like, oh my goodness, I'm healed. I'm healed. 12 years. I think she would have been easy to spot in the crowd. Pretty easy. And then Jesus says this. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. And he turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? I reckon the disciples went, oh, I don't know, but I reckon it's her over there with the big smile on her face. One going, I'm healed, hallelujah, I'm healed. Maybe, not saying that much, but you see the people around you, they said. They're pressing against you. His disciples answered, how can you ask such a question? Who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who'd done it. Then the woman, knowing that had happened to her, and because she fell, she came forward and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. And he said to her, how dare you reach out and touch me like that when I'm walking along? Don't you know that's not politically correct in this day and age? No. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Be freed from your suffering. Amazing, hey? What a good God. What a good God.
While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. Your daughter is dead. Now that word is dead, died. Book has closed. They said, why bother the teacher anymore? Overhearing what they said, Jesus said, do not be afraid, just believe. Now the synagogue guy has just seen this amazing thing of faith, hasn't he? Just believe. See what this girl's done? She's just reached out and touched me. I'm actually going to come into your house. Just believe. And when he got there, he did not allow anyone to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And when they came to the house, the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing. And he went in and said, why is all this commotion and all this wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. But they laughed at him, and after he had put them out. Now, do you think these guys are wailing and carrying on like pork chops, right? They're going for it. Now, you think Jesus would, excuse me, can you take the wailing outside, please? I'm just going to heal this person. You want to just move outside? What happened? How did Jesus get them out? How did he shoo them out of the building? It's this whole stuff's taking place. And he goes in, and finally, here was the child, and he took her by the hand, and he said to her, Talitha. Hold on. Talitha kahom. Now, why do you put those words in there for? Which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately, the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders for them not to let anyone know, as if... and told them to give her something to eat. Everyone would have been talking about that, wouldn't they? A little 12-year-old girl has just been raised from the dead. You want to tell everyone about that? Absolutely. One of my most amazing experiences in the Solomon Islands was in Solomon Island. Anyone been to Solomon Islands? The islands? They talk about this thing called island time. Is that right, Bruce? Island time. Things happen whenever. They're not. These things don't exist. You're hungry, you eat. You want to go fishing, you go fishing. Church happens when church happens. So we as white fellows go, church happens at 6 o'clock, sunrise. Okay, cool. So we get up at sunrise, church doesn't start for an hour. You guys are late. These are Baptists. And we're in the Church of Melanesia, which is Anglican. What's going on? Just whenever. 2 hours after church was supposed to start, the pastor turns up. The pastor turns up 2 hours late. And he's telling everybody, you know, sorry guys, sorry. He said, but last night my 2-year-old son died. Oh, how bad did we feel? We're sticking it to him behind his back as he's arriving late. Look, he's 2 hours late. We've got another village to go to. And his kids died. And so everyone starts getting around and they start to do the mourning and carrying on bit. And he says, no need to mourn. Here he is here, walking beside me, alive. We didn't have to have church that day. We had church right then and there. Marveled at the fact that this little 2-year-old boy is alive. The night before he was dead. And now he's alive. Talk about a disruption in his life. An inconvenience that kept coming along. Jesus' day went from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. An inconvenient and disruptive day. Now some of you, and there's a number of people that are fairly new, and you may not know that the relationship that Richie and I have is a good relationship. We actually do like each other, and when I pay out on Parramatta, that's because I love him. and he loves me, and if the Broncos lose this afternoon, I am sure I'll get a text message. Can't wait. Now I know Richie loves me because in his day on Friday, which was a disruptive day for him, so he's an electrician. Electricians aren't supposed to get dirty and dig ditches. They're supposed to, you know, have the easy work, you know. You're the apprentice, that's right. Richie had one of those days where he had to dig stuff, and when there's supposed to be just one wire coming in, there were four wires coming in, and it just was all over the place. And at the end, he got to finish up and go home, but instead of that, he caused himself a little bit more disruption by giving me a phone call and dropping around and sitting with me and having a couple of drinks out at my fire pit. The fire wasn't on, for those that have got the fire ban, the fire pit, and we just sat for a couple of hours chatting about life, about my mum, because he didn't mind disrupting his day. He could have been home with his kids and his wife, but he just come and hung out with a mate because his mate was having a tough week. Disruption can be a good thing. It doesn't have to be a bad thing. I'm sure that Jesus got up on this day, he had a plan. And I don't think his plan worked out the way that he hoped it to. I want to take you to Acts chapter 9, where another guy was having a disruptive day. Acts chapter 9, verse 1, it says this: "Meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and he asked him for letters of the synagogues in Damascus. And so he found any of those who belonged to the way, Christians, whether men, women, or children, he would go and put them in prison to Jerusalem. As he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him, and he fell to the ground, and he heard a voice say, 'Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?' 'Who are you, Lord?' Saul asked. 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting,' he replied. 'Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do.'" I think Paul's day was disrupted. I think he ran into an inconvenient truth. His day was meant to be breathing murderous threats against the people of God, the way, followers of Jesus. And lo and behold, a bright light gets in his face, and he realizes he's actually persecuting Jesus. Now, from that point of time, Paul's life is changed. At this time, he goes blind, and then he gets to see again, and then he goes about becoming one of the most amazing missionaries in the early church, an apostle. Paul was disrupted by Jesus. His life was never the same again. The inconvenience of meeting Jesus meant major cost on Paul's life. Paul was committed to Jesus, 100%. Paul was committed to the priority of the church. Everything he was about was planting the church, building the church up. All those letters that you read, all those irons, I-A-N's, Ian's, they're all about building the church up, bringing correction. The book of Corinthians, helping that church in Corinth to be a better church, to be able to follow Jesus better. Ephesians, Colossians, Thessalonians 1 and 2, all about building the church up. He was committed to the church. I am pretty sure that if Paul was here in 1976, once a fortnight to church, wouldn't have been Paul's thing. If you read through the book of Acts, it would have been every opportunity he got. As a tent maker, he would be at the synagogue preaching the gospel, or at someone's house or somewhere else. He was committed to the priority of the church in his life. The church, the people of God, because there were no church buildings around, was there? They went to the synagogue. They went to people's houses. They met in parks or down by the river. But the church was the people. Paul was committed to the people and equipping them. Paul was committed to his calling, the calling of God on his life. And he committed so much so that he ended up being executed for it. But he got to stand before the emperor in Rome, got to stand before kings and testify about Jesus. Paul was committed to Jesus. He was committed to the priority of the church in and through his life, and he was committed to the calling of God on his life. His life was disrupted for sure. He went places which I don't think he ever thought he would go. As a young fella growing up, the Sunshine Coast was a place that only north side of Brisbane went to. I was on the south side. We just went to the Gold Coast and Byron Bay. When I had people in my friendship group that were going to Noosa, we went, why would you want to travel all the way to Noosa? Because back in those days, I'm sure it took 14 hours. Whereas the Gold Coast was just down the road, 4 hours. And an old E.H. Holden. Anyway. And yet, God disrupted a family living in Logan City. Disrupted us and called us to the Sunshine Coast. Jamie was not happy about having to move to the Sunshine Coast. I don't want to go up there. But we got here. And for some reason, you guys have kept us around for coming up to 15 years. The disruption of God in your life can be a good thing. Amen. The Moravians back in the 18th century, or for those who get confused, the 1700s, started a prayer meeting. They started a prayer meeting. How committed about prayer are we, are you and I? When there's an opportunity to pray, do we come and pray? Or do we say we're busy or other things on or someone else will pray? The Moravians started a prayer meeting. It was a 24/7 prayer meeting, and it lasted. You know how long it lasted?
100 years. Now, I've sat and thought, when would we do a prayer meeting? If we did it on a Monday night, oh no, there's home groups on Monday nights. If we did it, oh, there's bread Tuesday nights. If we did, oh, K2's Wednesday nights. If we did Thursday nights is praise and worship practice. If we did Friday nights youth group. If we did Saturday. Oh, everyone goes out Saturday nights. We do Sunday night. Oh, Sunday night is the other church meets here. Oh, we can't do a prayer meeting. Like, this is the only place we could meet for a prayer meeting. These guys got together, and out of this, a guy called Count Zinzendorf, amazing man, built a place where people could come and grow in the faith. They were disrupted. And in and through that prayer meeting, missionaries went out again and again and again. But not just missionaries that went short term, and short term is good. By the way, if you want to go to Malawi, come and see us. I'd love for us to go again next year. There are 4 spots available. There are normally only 4 spots available, but for some reason, next year, all 4 are still available. They rang us again Thursday to confirm, are we coming? And I said, look, we've had a few things happen in our church. Malawi's probably dropped off a little bit, but we will talk, and if we're going, we'll get that up and going again. It'll probably be for a 3-week time period, and we'll probably go around June, July if we can get a team together. Okay, enough of that ad. But short-term missions are good. These missionaries that came out of the Moravian church, they didn't go short-term. They didn't go long-term. They went life-term. Some of these Moravians who came out of the prayer meetings sold themselves into slavery so as to reach the slaves. Now, that's a full-on ministry, isn't it? That's not like I'm going down the surf club and to reach the people on the beach in the sun, and then I'm going for a surf afterwards because it's nice in the water. This is sold into slavery so you can get beside the slaves so you can introduce them to Jesus. It's not like after 2 years you go, yeah, okay, this ministry is not working for me. I've had enough. No, you're sold into slavery. There's no going back. The Moravians, were they disrupted? Were they inconvenienced? Yes, they were. A guy called Mac Pia, the month before he got married, his mother-in-law, a lady called June Johnson, who I don't think is a relation. She's an American, so there's lots of Johnsons over there. She gave him a book called Prayer. It was written by a Norwegian Lutheran. I just found that humorous, a Norwegian Lutheran. His name was O. Hallesby. He wrote the book in 1931, and he said this, the definition of prayer is helplessness. The definition of prayer is helplessness. That we get to a point where we're helpless, we will really call out in prayer. And most of the time when we're not helpless, guess what? We don't pray. We don't feel the need to pray. I don't feel the need to pray. Donnie can fix things. Although in my house, they don't think I fix things real well because I call the other people to fix it after I fix it. But I like to try and do stuff. I like to fix problems. Sometimes I just need to listen. This guy, in his book, reading through it, was challenged by it. Mac Pier, after he got married, started a ministry in New York City in the mid-1980s, right through. Anyone remember New York City back in those days? 1980s, 1990s? Full of race riots, full of murder, full of violence. Not a good place to live. This pastor got to a point where he was helpless in the area of his church. His church was not going anywhere. And he read another book, which by a guy called Jonathan Edwards. Anyone know Jonathan Edwards? Apparently started the American Revival. Was a guy that would pray at night time, all through the night, which is fine. We would think praying through the night, that's no problem. But he would do it in winter in snow. And he would be outside as snow fell on him, and it just would evaporate around him as he was in fervor of prayer. Jonathan Edwards was an incredible man of God. And he started something called Concerts of Prayer. Concerts of Prayer. And this guy, Mac Pier, read this book, and he thought, okay, I'm going to grab hold of this vision.
And the idea of concerts of prayer was Christians, by an expression of agreement, coming together in a vision, a visible union. I'll say that again. Christians, by an expressing agreement, coming together as a visible union. So concerts of prayer was people coming together from all different denominations, all different churches, all different walks of life, all different places to pray and to seek God's face. So in 1989, this pastor, Mac Pier, grabbed together another couple. In just four of them met in his bedroom, not bedroom, lounge room. And they met for prayer, their first concert of prayer. It was a fairly small concert, but it was still a concert. They met together. By the end of 1989, seven of the New York City's geographical areas were meeting together to pray in these concerts of prayer. By 1990, 400 pastors met at the Brooklyn Tabernacle to pray. 400 pastors in one place praying. Some of those pastors traveled for more than 4 hours to get to that prayer meeting so they could pray through the night for New York City. In 1992, 350 leaders came together and met for 48 hours so as to pray through things for their city. In 1994, New York's murder rate went through the roof to the highest ever, 2,400 murders in 1994. These pastors sat down with the government and said, "What's the problem?" And they said, "If you could pray into this specifically, that would be great." And so these prayer meetings, these concerts of prayer, started to pray into the high murder rate and a whole bunch of other things that were listed out. By 2013, in New York City, there was only 333 murders. Only. That's still a lot. But that's a decrease of 86%. That's significant, of praying into your city. Mac Pier believes in praying for your city. In May this year, the leadership team gave me the opportunity to go down to a convention in Sydney. Yeah, Sydney. It was called a Movement Day. It was for 2 days. But it was called Movement Day. And on those 2 days, stories like Mac Pier's story and other stories from other cities were told again and again and again. A little guy from South Korea got up, and he was in out of Liverpool City in Sydney. And he started off his sharing by saying, "We have a very big mosque in Liverpool City, and the imam there has come out and declared that their goal is to make Liverpool City 100% Muslim. 100% Muslim." And he said, "That's a problem, because I live in Liverpool City and I'm not a Muslim, I'm a believer in Jesus." They have started a movement called Liverpool for Jesus. And they're seeing amazing things take place. Amazing things. They felt the helplessness in their city and they went to prayer. They went to prayer. I don't know how you're feeling, whether you're helpless, whether you feel like our church needs more prayer. I know we need more prayer, and that's not saying we're not praying. We are. The leadership team are very fervent in their prayers, both when they get together and when they're outside of it. I know every Thursday that I pray for that leadership team. I intercede on their behalf, and I know that when I send them a text message, I know they stop and they think and pray as well. So we're prayerful for us as a city. We're prayerful for us as a church. But we need to be more. We're being disrupted at the moment, where there's a bit of inconvenience for us as a church and as a community. I was sharing with some people this week, and they were talking about back in the 1990s, these things were happening. And if the 1990s was looking at 2018, they'd be absolutely horrified at the world that we're living in now. And they said the 1990s was a tough period to live in. Are we helpless enough? Are we convinced enough to pray, to break through, to stand in the gap, to be the people that God has called us to be? I want to give us a couple of challenges, and then I want to pray. First one is, there is an opportunity next Sunday afternoon, and this sermon's not all about next Sunday afternoon, but there's an opportunity for us to have a visible union of coming together at 4:30 down at Bell's in Unity College, where we have the opportunity as the Church of Caloundra City to come together, to pray,
to hear a word from God, to sing, and to be one people called by God. I'd love to see as many of us to come to that as possible. I know of 7 other churches that are buying into it big time, and hopefully this week I'll have some time to disrupt and inconvenience the life of a few other pastors to have them come and join us with their church as well. The other one is to stop and think about how our lives probably need to be disrupted a little bit more, have a little bit more of an inconvenience with the call of Jesus upon us. Remembering that Paul was committed to Jesus, committed to the priority of the church, and committed to his call. And I believe all of us should be committed to Jesus, committed to the priority of the church, the people, and also committed to the call of God on each of our lives. And having said that, I want to pray this prayer. Jesus, today we give you permission to completely disrupt our lives in concert with your greater purposes. We pray that you will give us the courage to be fully available to you. Teach us that we need to know. Tell us where we need to go. And show us to whom to join in this journey toward greater consequence in our lives. In your name, amen.